Coming up on episode 197 of Wheel Bearings, Roberto Baldwin drives the Acura TLX Type S at Laguna Seca and the Ducati Multistrada V4. Nicole and I take polar opposites from the GM SUV lineup, the 2021 Chevy Suburban, and I have the 2021 Buick Envision. In the news, we talk about the F-150 Lightning Pro. Ford and SK Innovation team up to produce lithium-ion batteries. Kia launches their new EV6. And we talk about the weight problem with the Hummer EV. And we answer some listener questions. And finally, if you like the show, please make sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to listen that allows reviews. Thanks.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 197 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual-Samage from Guidehouse Insights.
I'm Nicole Wakelin from AutoByTel.
And I am Roberto Baldwin, and I have a new YouTube channel called Roll. So just look up Roberto Baldwin on YouTube and you'll figure it out.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent. Well, who wants to go first? Robbie, what'd you drive this week?
I will go first. It wasn't this past week, but it was a few weeks ago, probably. I drove the new Acura 2021 TLX Type S.
Type S is back.
Ooh.
Type S is back. Acura is back as a performance. I mean, they came back with the NSX in 2015, but you know, not everyone can afford an NSX. Very few people
what?
Can afford.
You're kidding.
I know. I've been asking around. It turns out not everyone's independently wealthy.
Well, and even of those who are independently wealthy, very few of them are buying NSXs, unfortunately.
Which is insane because the NSX is an amazing vehicle.
Agreed.
It's so wonderful. You get all the fun of a supercar and all the reliability and dependability of an Acura / Honda.
Indeed.
What's there not to love? So I drove the Acura TLX Type S. They let me drive it at Laguna Seca, which was fun.
That's always a bonus.
Yeah, I got to drive it down the Corkscrew. It is an impressive vehicle. I was pleasantly surprised. It is quick. It has a turbocharged, it's dual spool turbocharged V6, which they built specifically for this vehicle. It has, you put it, what's nice is when you get into one of these vehicles and when you put this thing in sport plus mode, you can feel the tension, like the steering ratio changes. You feel everything getting ready to attack whatever you're about to do. But then you put it in comfort mode and it's actually, a very comfortable vehicle. You could, drive it to Vegas or I don't know, whatever people do on the weekends, drive really far.
I love it when that button actually makes a difference, because sometimes you push the, sport comfort button and you're sitting like, I feel absolutely nothing. I hear absolutely nothing. Like, you can't tell the difference. So
exactly, all they do is remap the pedal.
Yeah, you're like, this is nothing anybody can tell.
But no, it's, you know, they pulled the brake system over from the NSX, which is great because the brake throw is really short, but it's not like the Giulia where if you step on it and all of a sudden you're like, ugh, you know, you still have a lot of control, but it's very short. And I love good brakes because good brakes keep me from running into things.
This is true. I'm looking at it right now. I like pulled up the website as we're talking. $52,000. That's all it starts at. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit cheaper than I think the A4 and whatever BMW. I
forget what the BMW. That's kind of impressive for 52.
Yeah,
50,300 to be precise, according to their site. So
it is a very tech orientated, sports sedan. You know, they're using electronic brakes. They're adjusting the steering ratio and everything through electronics. Everything is electronic, which most cars, you know, they do it, but the automaker doesn't really make a big deal about it. Right. And Acura is sort of saying, yeah, we're doing this. And the result is a pretty large, wide sedan that feels smaller than it actually is when you're driving it, which to me is always a plus. When you get into a sports sedan and it ends up feeling like, you know, whatever series or whatever class lower than what it is, if it feels smaller and nimble, then that's, you know, A plus. Good job, engineers.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's nice, you know, when you have a car that you're going to be using it as a daily driver, to have that little bit of extra room to spread out, especially, I mean, your case, you know, you're tall, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so having that extra room, I'm sure you appreciate. But then, you know, to not have it feel like it's huge when you're going out, you know, hitting the country roads on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, it is. I really, really liked it. I was, I've been a Honda fan ever since, you know, my second car, which was a Honda, and then my third car was my Honda, and then my fourth car was a Honda. But, you know, you have to sort of look at where the market is and where this car fits in that segment. And in that segment, it's a pretty screaming deal. And it's the return of the Type S. And, you know, they're going to be an MDX is going to have a Type S, of course, because everyone has to have a really fast SUV. But there's going to be more Type S's coming down the line, which I'm very happy to report. And, yeah, Acura is properly coming back as that, you know, the precision crafted performance brand within Honda.
Yeah, I saw the MDX coming as a Type S. I love that car. So I'm excited to see a Type S in that. That makes me happy.
So yeah. I've got a question for you, Robbie, since we haven't talked about an Acura since you joined the lineup. I'm curious to hear your impressions of the Acura type touchpad, because it's been a fairly controversial element ever since they launched it on the RDX a couple of years ago.
So I use a tablet with a pen, like a Wacom tablet. And the way a tablet works instead of like a touchpad is wherever my pen is, that's where the mouse is on the screen.
So positioning.
Absolute positioning. That's what I use when I use a computer, when I work on computer. I'm actually holding my pen right now. It's just like second nature to have it in my head.
He's waving it at the screen as proof.
I'm waving it. And so when they put me in the RDX, when they first launched it, I was like, oh, this makes complete sense to me. And, you know, I've gotten in the MDX last week when I went to drive the TLX and then went to TLX. So I actually like it just because I don't have to reach really far. They have that little area where you can place your hand. And wherever my finger is, that's where it is on screen. And so if I learn that the navigation is the top left-hand corner, I just put my finger in the top left-hand corner. I don't have to look at the screen. I don't have to look at the touchpad. I can look at the road and enable that. It's sort of the closest thing to having that muscle memory of where the buttons are when you actually have buttons in your car. You know, you just kind of reach over and you turn up the heat, turn it down, or adjust the volume. It's almost like that. And so I understand people who are like absolutely hate it, but I think if you had it for like a few weeks, you would sort of, I think you would get used to it.
So Roberto is the one person that likes no, I'm just kidding. It's like, it feels like most people don't like it.
It's just you.
You like it, Sam?
I do like it, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I do think it's very confusing for people who are used to a touchpad on their laptop. And when they first do it, you know, you're used to swiping and moving and doing things. And I think that is very frustrating. And I've had a few people who have asked about, you know, in their computing lives, using like a Wacom tablet to work. And I'm like, the first 2 weeks are going to suck because it takes a while to rewire your brain to wherever your, you know, absolute positioning, wherever your hand is, wherever the pen is, that's where your mouse is. And so I think it's the same thing with Acura's touchpad system.
I think that's true. It just takes a little bit. Like if I spent more than a week at a time with it, it would probably become intuitive very quickly. It's just because we're always in these cars for a week or like, you know, a day when we're doing a drive program. But it does seem like it would just be something that you would get the hang of over time, you know, any of them, like using any infotainment, you just have to use them for a while. And most of them you start to become comfortable with.
But. Yeah. The big bummer, though, is that it doesn't work with Android Auto or CarPlay. So then you're like kind of scrolling like it's a Lexus, and then that's a pain in the ass. So there is that.
All right. So you also had something else that you're writing that you were talking about is just before we started recording.
Yeah, I rode in. I threw my helmet down. It's right behind my chair because I was running late. I am riding the Ducati Multistrada V4. And you know, it's a motorcycle. And if you're not into motorcycles, you know, fine. But what this bike has, it's the first production bike that has it, is radar for adaptive cruise control and blind spot monitoring. So you can turn on adaptive cruise control on a motorcycle, and I've been using it and it works really well. And my concern was, you know, there's a complacency when you drive a car, when you start using adaptive cruise control and lane keep assist, you sort of start getting lazy about paying attention to what's going on. I think where the difference is when you ride a motorcycle is that you're tuned to always be super uber alert about what's going on around you. So that, for me, that hasn't changed while I'm using it. So if you're a very alert motorcycle rider, then it'll be unlikely that that's going to change, but it does make it so your right hand, you don't get that like claw of always holding the accelerator the entire time, you know, rolling up, you know, every time I have to move, if you have to do anything with your right hand, whenever you let go, the motorcycle just slows down.
So this isn't a sport bike, right? I forget what the classification of this bike is.
It is it's the Multistrada line and okay. Multi-Mini and then Strada. It's so the idea is that
Multi-Streets.
It's four different bikes in one. So it's a touring bike. You can set it in sport bike mode. You can set it in enduro mode. You go off-road. And then there is an urban setting that makes it easier. The shifts aren't as they're smoother. It's a smoother shifting because you're shifting so much when you're in an urban environment. And the first time I rode one of these, I rode the 1260 a few years ago. I was like, okay, it's the jack of all trades, master of none. And that's how I went into it. And it's, you know, it's they're expensive bikes, you know, but it actually feels like all those bikes when you do it. And, you know, it's not the best sport bike. It's not the best enduro bike. It's not, but it is a really good, almost like facsimile of those bikes while you're riding. It's sort of, I buy this one bike and I can do all the things I want to do instead of buying a sport bike and an enduro bike and a touring bike and a commuter bike. I can buy one bike, have all those things. And most of the time, you know, with these bikes, people either are touring with them or they're commuting with them because they have a very high, you know, a high seating position. You can see pretty far. They're great for commuting. You know, I had to do a lot of lane splitting to get here. I still was late, but to get here, not
so
crazy
said,
late.
You said it's an expensive bike. So what counts as, like, what is an expensive bike?
Like $20,000? Like it's, you know,
I'm the person who doesn't know a lot about motorcycles. Well, I'll fess up to begin with. So I'm like, what counts as an expensive bike? I was curious.
Compared to a Harley Livewire, that's a bargain.
Well, yeah. I mean, I am torn by the Harley Livewire because you can get a Zero. Zero is an electric motorcycle company. They've been around for years. Their bikes are just getting progressively better. Everyone got excited about the Harley Livewire because it's Harley, it's the Livewire, but the Zero is like $10,000 cheaper.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, you're sort of paying for the Harley name. And I haven't ridden the Livewire. That's yet, so I can't like really judge it on how well it rides or doesn't ride. But those Zeros, especially the last 5 years, they've really brought it. They've put out some really great bikes with some wonderful accessories and components. They have sort of bikes for different types of riding. I'm gonna let my cat out because he's just sitting there meowing.
Your poor cat in the background. I was wondering whose cat it was.
Hold on, give me 2 seconds. The catio was right outside my window.
The
in my
what?
Office. Like I built a catio. It's like a patio for your cats, so they can go outside, but they don't like go outside. They don't.
You're like screened in, like a screen.
Yeah, it's like screened in. It's like a lanai for your cats.
Like a little screened in porch for your kitty. Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So he came in, and then suddenly he needed out of here. But yeah, it starts at $20,000. It's a fun bike. I really and adding the any additional safety on a bike is always I'm always all for it.
Yeah, and especially something like the blind spot monitoring seems like that would be a really handy feature to have.
Yeah, they're for the most part when you're riding or when I'm riding at least I am constantly checking my mirrors, but there's also that look back where you're looking left and right before you change lanes. But every once in a while you look in your mirror and someone's just flying and you don't see them and you miss them. You start to move over and all of a sudden you're just,
yeah.
And you just, you're like, you're that close to death. And so having the blind spot, Mari, like it pops up on your side mirror, like it does in an automobile. And you're like, oh, there's a car coming or there's a car right there. And so, that right there to me is that's worth the price of admission. And the adaptive cruise control is fun. It's great. It keeps your right hand from getting tired. But the blind spot monitoring, it's pretty great. They have.
Is
that
it like a car where you have to like start paying extra to get these little bits on the motorcycle, or do they like the trim level kind of thing, or is it on everyone? Like,
it's on everyone. It's sort of their selling point for this one.
Okay.
But I can see where they're they can kind of start selling things.
I was just curious if it was like if you want this nifty gadget you got to pay an extra x number of dollars
or start doing a subscription where you pay by the month for it.
Oh yeah, everyone loves that.
Nicole,
yeah,
what have you been driving?
I'm driving a very tiny little vehicle that is easy to drive around.
Chevy Spark.
Yeah, sure. Chevy Suburban. It is
same
huge.
Thing.
Same thing. They're practically the same. I don't know that there's
both
much
have
of a
five
difference.
Doors, right?
Yeah,
four doors.
I don't understand why they sell both of them. They should really just have one. Yeah. So I was driving the Suburban so I could, rip my house off a foundation if I wanted and just tow it along with me, or maybe just stick it in the back seat because it's that big. It's huge. It is a huge vehicle, but I have the one with the 3-liter turbo diesel.
So really could pull your house off the foundation.
I really could pull my house right off the foundation should I choose to. So that's 277 horsepower, 460 pound-feet of torque. What's freaky about driving it when you're not actually towing anything is that you mash the gas and it's huge. Like you have this sense of like, I'm getting on the highway. I'm going to need to move. I had better hit that gas hard or I'm going nowhere. But with that turbo diesel and nothing, you take off like nobody's business. It's like, whoops. Okay. Let me ease up on that a little bit. I don't need all that power when there's nothing in it, but me and my husband, that's it. I like driving it. It was funny. We had a contractor at the house for something and he was all about it. He's like, I want to replace my truck with this. I want to get this instead. So he was all excited because of the diesel. That was his entire reason for wanting. He's like, I wouldn't get it without a diesel because I need something that has the oomph to be able to tow. What is this tow up to 8,000 pounds that this can tow? So I thought that was interesting that he's a truck guy, just a truck guy. But he's thinking, okay, I could actually move over to this because this gives me the benefits of having all the extra seating and the versatility, but it still can do some truck guy stuff and do the work he needs it to do. And it's a beautiful interior. I mean, it's not cheap. This was, I got to double check here, $82,000. So it's not an inexpensive choice. But if you're going to go for something that's, you want that large SUV and you need the capability, I mean, it's a great way to go. And it has cool standard stuff. Like it is a 10.2 inch touchscreen. I love it when you don't have to that's standard. Like, you don't have to like, oh, you're going to get a 4-inch touchscreen on the very base trim. If you want anything extra, shell out some money. It's like, no, you can get the base one. You're still going to get this giant touchscreen. So I was pleased with it. I liked it.
Cool. And yeah. What kind of fuel economy did you get with it?
I never look at fuel economy. Oh. I'm just terrible. I know I should. It's something I never think to look at in a vehicle. So, I should pay more attention, Sam. I mean,
especially with the diesel.
Yeah.
You know, I think in that vehicle, I think that's an interesting element because, you know, right now I've got Cadillac Escalade in the driveway that's got the 6.2 liter V8. Mm-hmm. And it has a thirst for petroleum products. I can't remember the pricing in the Suburban, but in the Cadillac, you can choose either the 6.2 gas V8 or the diesel for the same price. There's no price premium for the diesel. And I think that the price premium on the Chevy is about $2,500 or something.
Actually,
like that.
I'm double checking. It's saying $1,500. If I'm reading that
okay,
right.
Is that all? Okay.
I believe it's 15. I'm looking at a sort of blurry copy of a Monroney here. But it looks like it's about 15 for the diesel, which isn't that bad. It's a little upgrade. But the fuel economy it's supposed to get, it's supposed to be 22 combined, which not bad, not great, but it's big. Well, I mean, this is not a small vehicle. This is huge. So 22 mpg, and if you're in a diesel, that's actually not that bad.
For something that can carry 8 passengers and tow 8,000 pounds, you know, I mean, that's, you can't complain about that.
It is not a Spark, you know.
No, it is not. You could park a couple of Sparks in the back if you fold the seats down.
You could park a couple in the back, tow a few on the back. You could just have a fleet of Sparks wherever you go. Everyone could get out of the vehicle and get into their own Spark and go about their business.
When you go into Boston, you know, you can park the Suburban on the perimeter and then just drive the Spark into town. You know,
It's the last mile solution. Your last mile solution is buy a Suburban and put a Spark inside of it.
It's like, you know, back in the late 80s or early 90s, Honda had a car in the Japanese market, a K car. It was the Honda City, I think, or it was either the City or the Today that actually had a little fold up motor scooter that went in the back. You know, so you could take that out, you know, fold up the handlebars and everything and ride off in that thing. Same thing, you know, with the Spark and a Suburban.
Right.
You know, and you can actually park the Spark in downtown Boston.
You could, and then it wouldn't be a scooter, so you would not be frozen to death for 6 months of the year riding your scooter into Boston. You would be.
Precisely. So I also had a GM vehicle this week, a GM SUV that's a little bit smaller than the Suburban. I had the new Buick Envision, which is the second generation of the Envision. And the Envision, for those that don't recall, is the first product that GM has imported to North America from China. It's actually built in China. It's built exclusively in China. It's a compact crossover, you know, same size as an Equinox or RAV4, CRV, Ford Escape. And, you know, I think it's a really nice size. You know, the first generation Envision was, you know, it was a nice vehicle to drive, but it was a little frumpy looking. You know, it wasn't real exciting to look at. Yeah, this new one, you know, has, I think, a much more contemporary style to it. You know, it's got in a lot of ways, it's more like the Mazda CX-5, where, you know, they push the A-pillars, the base of the windshield, back a little bit. So you've got a little bit of that longer hood profile, you know, even though it's a front-wheel drive/all-wheel drive crossover. But it, you know, The interior, you know, is really nicely done. The touchscreen is angled towards the driver, you know, so, you know, very easy to hit that, very easy to see it. It's got the only engine available in there is the 2-liter four-cylinder turbo, GM's 2-liter four-cylinder turbo. In this particular vehicle, it's rated at 228 horsepower and 258 pounds-feet of torque. And, you know, again, it feels, you know, feels plenty strong enough. You know, there's no shortage of performance here. You know, it's not going to outrun, you know, a Tesla Model Y performance or anything like that. But, you know, it's more than adequate for, you know, all of your daily driving needs. the model I had also had all wheel drive, and its fuel economy is rated at 22 city, 29 highway. I got 26 all around over the course of a week. It's really nice to drive, and you know, quite quiet on the highway. The one I had didn't have all of the the kinds of ADAS, you know, driver assist features we've come to expect on a lot of vehicles today, like, you know, adaptive cruise control. It did have blind spot monitoring and forward collision alert, but no ACC, which was a little bit annoying because I had to drive it all the way out to, you know, to Romeo, Michigan, to the Ford Proving Grounds to for the demo on the F-150 Lightning. And, you know, that's it's like a 90 mile drive from my home. So I would have liked to have had, and you know, I had to be there at 8 a.m. So very early, I would have liked to have had ACC for that trip, but alas, I had to, monitor my distance to other vehicles the whole time.
All on your own. Oh.
I know.
Oh, there's a motorcycle you could have ridden there.
I know.
I know. I'm aware of,
but, 9-speed automatic, said, you know, materials and fit and finish inside was, you know, was first rate, no complaints there. And it is priced, the one I had was priced at $41,790. So this was the Essence model, which is the high-end trim, starts at $37,600. This one was almost $42,000, including delivery. Interestingly, even though it's coming from China, the delivery charge is only $1,200. I know in the past and over the past year, we've talked about delivery charges on some vehicles and how they keep creeping up, in a kind of hidden price increase, particularly at FCA. You know, they're charging something like $1,700 for delivery fees now on the Rams and the Jeeps. So $1,200 is a relative bargain for that on this one. Generally, you know, really nice, slightly more premium compact crossover. You know, so if you're looking at something like the Lexus NX or the, the Lincoln Corsair, like the base trim levels of the Corsair, you might want to take a look at one of these as an alternative. You might like the style a little better or different, especially compared to the Lexus. Definitely worth taking a look at.
I had that back in February, so a couple months back now. And I had the similar feelings about it as you did. And I liked that the interior on it, Buick does a good job. You know, they want to be the upscale brand, but how do you be upscale without being so upscale that you become truly a luxury car brand that's stupidly expensive? And they walk a fine line there. It does feel, the interior is a really, it's attractive. It's elegant. They do a good job for the prices. Because what'd you say? That's like 41 something.
Yeah, just shy of 42 grand.
Just for a 42. And it, you know, you don't get inside. It doesn't have that, you know, $60,000 luxury car kind of aesthetic. But it feels like you did a little something extra. I think they did a good job about giving it a little bit of extra just with the way they've done some of the trims and the quality of the materials. So I was a big fan of the Envision.
Yeah, and the exterior design, too, I think, you know, really stepped it up this time around for the second generation model.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, let's jump into some news items. Let's start off with an electric pickup truck that, for the moment at least, is not the Ford F-150 Lightning. the GMC Hummer EV that is launching this fall. An interesting little tidbit of news came out a few days ago about
this. It's not a little tidbit, technically. It's a huge tidbit.
It is.
Mm-hmm, right?
I mean, you know, this is a pretty big truck, although it's actually not as big as the F-150. You know, it's kind of slots in between a midsize like the Colorado and a full size like the Silverado. Mm. And this thing weighs 9,034 pounds curb weight.
9,000 pounds.
It's a beefy truck. I've seen it in real life. I've sat in it. There are a lot of H's on it, which I assume are where all the weight comes from, because everything is an H. It must be, because 9,000
H is a big letter. So
pounds.
Yeah. 9,000. What do you do to make this thing weigh 9,000? I want to know what was the structure like. Well, we can't really do any weight savings, so just to hell with it. 9,000 pounds it is. Like, what happened there?
Yeah, I'm assuming, you know, they've talked a lot about how they reduced the development time, you know, and they did this whole program in like 26 months from, you know, start of the program till job one. And apparently, you know, they kind of skipped over the step where they do weight optimization.
That was like, we cut this out, man. Yeah, we can be ready in no time.
Let's just make the entire underbody skid plate out of cast iron. Maybe lead.
Yeah. And there is nothing more Hummer than the fact that the EV weighs 9,000 pounds. That is on brand. That is.
This is true. This is true. Yeah, it's totally over the top, which is Hummer. So I guess they're staying true.
Well, and just for reference, you know, if you think back to the original H1 Hummer, which was the civilian version of the military Humvee.
How much did that weigh?
Those only weighed 8,000 pounds.
Oh, my God.
So this is 1,000 pounds heavier than
that. How are they doing this? I feel like there's an engineer somewhere listening going, wait, I can explain. Hold on a second.
Yeah. Now, granted, I talked to a rep from GMC the other day, you know, just to verify this when the news came out. And he said, yeah, that's the weight for the edition one or first edition or whatever the first one they're building is. Hmm. And that one's loaded. I mean, it's got no options. Everything is standard on there, including like 18 cameras. But, you know, I mean, cameras, you know, they weigh a
How
few ounces.
How big are the cameras? I mean, I'm like, that would you'd use like an NBC or something mounted on each corner of the car.
I think they must
be
using
like
big Hasselblads or something mounted all over the car.
I mean, it's almost part of that sort of weird, that game where you have weight versus battery. Like how much, you know, they want 350 miles, so they have to add more battery, but that added more weight, but you need more battery in order to move the weight of the battery. And then it's just this big chunky truck. And so it's just like, well, how much is that is battery and how much, you know, where is the line? Where is the,
yeah,
where
you do wonder you, what, like sort of like the break even point version, like, you know, like where the adding extra battery, the weight no longer makes it worth it to keep doing this, you know?
Well, they've said, you know, it's a 200 kilowatt hour battery for this one. And, you know, and I think that they've said, you know, that the energy density of this battery, their new Ultium batteries, is somewhere around 250 watt hours per kilogram. So this battery should weigh about somewhere between 25 and 2,700 pounds, which is, you know, bigger than most other EVs, but most other EVs, you know, have at most like 100 to 140 kilowatt hour battery. This is 200 kilowatt hours. Yeah, it's going to be heavy, but still, that's only, you know, let's be conservative and say, you know, 2,800 pounds. You know, where the hell is the other, you know, 6,500 pounds in this thing?
I'm baffled. I don't know when we see it. Well, you've seen it, Roberto. Does it?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, is it all the H's? I mean, like you said, it is it all just H
it
weight?
It feels heavy. It feels big and heavy. Just looking at it, like I didn't pick it up.
It looks heavy, but
it looks heavy. You walk up to it, you're like, this feels. It's husky, I guess you would call it. I don't know.
It's like you nicely called it fat. Oh, he's just husky. Yeah.
He's husky. He's big. It's big. It's got big bones.
I mean, it has a quintessential American vehicle, you know, morbidly obese, you know.
It is.
None of us are ever going to drive this car now. They're going to be like, get them, none of them, all the way from
no, in. Get away from our Hummer EV. I mean, if I get in and it drives great, fine. But it is, it is something else. It is. And
yeah, I mean, 1,000 horsepower and, you know, 0 to 60 in 3 seconds, you know.
I guess, right, if it performs the way it's supposed to perform, who cares how much it weighs? Is that going to be what it comes down to?
Well, I think one of the challenges, you know, there's actually a lot of roads in the United States or a lot of bridges that you cannot cross with a vehicle that weighs over 8,500 pounds.
Oh, wait, you're kidding me. It's like 85, like a magic number?
Yeah,
8,500
is the upper limit for class 1 and class 2A vehicles. So once you go past 8,500 pounds gross vehicle weight, so that's the weight of the vehicle plus whatever payload is in it, then you're into class 2B, you're into medium duty trucks. And, you know, this is 9,000 pounds empty.
So, right, with nobody in it, no cargo, nothing.
You know, you put, you know, 4 adults in this thing and some cargo, you know, you're going to be certainly over 10,000 pounds, you know, and maybe potentially approaching 11, depending on how much gear you've got with you.
It's 5 tons of fun with you and all your friends. That's what it is.
It certainly is. It better be fun with that weight.
This, yeah.
Now I really am. Now I'm really curious to see, because I've been curious to see it because it does look really neat. And I wanted to see it in person at some point, obviously. But seeing like pictures and then seeing that 9,000 pound number, I'm like, now I really want to see it. Like, I want to, like, does it feel like 9,000 pounds? Like, are the doors, like, you need to, like, work out to be able to shut the doors? Yeah, I want to know what makes it 9,000 pounds.
I saw it at the EV day at GM last year, you know, and Grant, you know, the one they had there was actually still a clay model. It wasn't even a full mock-up of, you know, full prototype. And, you know, it's big, but I mean, it doesn't look especially enormous compared to a lot of modern trucks. I mean, compared to the Ram TRX I drove a couple of weeks ago, it's not really any bigger than that. In fact, I think it might be like physically dimensionally smaller than the TRX. And the TRX weighs like 6,500 pounds.
I pulled up next to a TRX with my daughter and she was in her new little Rogue Sport and I felt so small. I was like, oh my God, it's like the TRX is just towering above us as she's pulling into the spot.
You should try sitting next to it in a Miata.
Even more so. I feel like it could drive over you. You might have the clearance to do that.
Almost. Not quite. But yeah, I pulled out my Miata into the driveway to wash it when I had the TRX and, you know, had it parked next to it. And I'm looking up at this thing. It's like, oh, boy.
Pull under and change the oil in your Miata, then pull back out.
Yeah. Just lay on the roof on your back. You can do the whole thing.
Sticking with electric pickup trucks, a little more on the F-150 Lightning, which has now been revealed. By the time that this recording is out, we'll have the official word out on the F-150 Lightning Pro, which is the commercial truck version. So this is, even though it's badged as Pro, it's actually the base version of the F-150 Lightning, which is the electric F-150. And, you know, this is the one that's targeting commercial customers. And I actually wouldn't be surprised if this is actually the best selling version of the Lightning, because, you know, there's a lot of appeal for commercial customers for this thing, you know, especially in terms of low operating costs. This is the one when they talk about a $40,000 F-150 Lightning. This is the one that's going to be 40 grand is the Lightning Pro with the standard range battery pack, 230-mile battery pack. The extended range version with 300 miles of range, that one's going to be $50,000, so 10 grand more for the extra 70 miles of range. And you know, so this is, I mean, this is going to be configured, you know, pretty much like an XL, like a regular F-150 XL, basic work truck, vinyl interior. But it still has, you know, a lot of features like the Pro Power on board, you know, to power your tools. It has a 12-inch, you know, touchscreen with Sync 4 in there. You know, and a lot of the other goodies, you know,
isn't it a fancier version of Sync? Did I read it's like Sync 4A or something, which is like the latest and greatest, fanciest version of Sync ever made?
4A is the version that's on the portrait 15.5-inch screen.
Ah, gotcha. So that's where I'm seeing the 4A.
The screen from the Mach-E, and that same 15.5-inch screen will be in the Lariat and Platinum versions of the Lightning.
It's only the top. Okay, I wasn't sure what got the 4A.
So. Yeah, so there's four trim levels. There's the Pro, which is the base, the XLT, which is the mid level, and then the Lariat and the Platinum. And the Lariat and the Platinum get the big screen, and the 4A, which has a slightly different user interface because, you know, the different layout. And then the 4 is just the landscape layout. Any thoughts on this thing?
Ford has been building, you know, commercial grade, you know, contractors, fleet, you know, the F-150, that's, you know, you look in almost any municipality, they probably have a ton of F-150s. If you talk to most contractors, are driving around in a white F-150. And so this is, you know, this is a huge, huge base of customers, and making sure they're like, hey, we're making this for you. And it has all these telematics and all this information that helps them sort of track how the truck's being used, you know, track individual drivers, like all the things are sort of baked into it. I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer, and it really, really, like, puts a stake in the heart of Lordstown, which was trying to like, hey, we're making a commercial grade truck for everyone to use. Like, are you going to buy the F-150 from Ford that's less expensive from a brand that's been around for 100 years, or are you going to buy from Lordstown, which is, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I was watching the briefing earlier today, on the commercial truck, and, you know, they talked about some things like, you know, from that telematics data that they have, you know, from all their customers, they found that 95% of the commercial users drive less than 175 miles a day, which is actually, you know, quite a bit, but 95%, you know, less than 175 miles. So that they figure for the vast majority of customers, that 230 mile range is actually going to be more than adequate. And then, you know, you've got the longer range version available as well. One of the other key things they mentioned, you know, is that Ford now 2,300 of Ford's dealers across the United States are EV certified. So they're certified to service these things, to work on these things. And they will have the tools and the spare parts. So even if you have something like a battery, you know, that has a bad module in it, that you can take it to a Ford, to one of these certified Ford dealers. They can pull that battery, replace the module, and have it back in and back to you the same day. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas Lordstown has no service network. You know, who's going to work on these things when they have problems, which they probably will. You know,
yeah.
Poor Lordstown.
Yeah.
I mean, Lordstown has been a boondoggle from the start. I mean, it's a company. Yeah. It's a company based on another failed company that's paying the failed company for every truck they build. So it's just when you look at just everything around Lordstown, you're just like, wait a second, what's going on here?
You know, I feel bad for the people that live in that area that got laid off when GM closed the plant, when they stopped building the crews there. And, you know, then, you know, Lordstown swept in, and you had some guy from Washington who came in and made a big deal about all this, you know, about how this was going to save, you know, the you know, the Northeast Ohio region, you know, turn it into what do they call it? Electron Alley, I think, or something like that.
I think it was Electric Avenue, that song from the 80s. So yeah. Everybody enjoy that earworm now.
Yeah. But you're right, Robbie. This, you know, Steve Burns, the CEO of Lordstown, you know, there was a lot of shady stuff that went on when he ran Workhorse Group. And, you know, Workhorse, you know, has never had much success at all. You know, and they essentially got this plant for free from GM. Yeah, they They paid GM $20 million for the factory, but GM had to give them a $40 million loan so that they could pay GM back $20 million for the factory. And they still had some cash left over because they
had some fun accounting.
Oh yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, the only reason that this enterprise even exists is because, you know, when GM shut down the plant, you know, they got so much bad press. They just wanted it to go away. And they said, fine, take the plant. We'll give you some money. You know, do something, please. You know, and you know, meanwhile, GM is building a battery plant, you know, basically next door. So,
well, when Lordstown, if Lordstown goes out of business, then they can just take back over that and build some more stuff. Or another automaker could like come in and like, you know,
they can just keep sell it to the next one and sell it to the next one and sell it to the next one. Yeah, so eventually they'll make a profit, right?
maybe when Rivian is ready for a second plant, they can come in and take it over.
They can be like, hey, guys, let's take that off your hands. We can help.
we got a lot of money in the bank and actual trucks to run. Yeah. If you
an actual vehicle, so hey.
And real partners, not letters of intent.
Next up. Kia EV6, as we record last night in Times Square, Kia had a big event and unveiled the EV6, which is their first purpose-built EV, not their first EV. They've had the Soul before, and they've got the Kia Niro EV as well. Mm-hmm. But the EV6 is their first entry off of this new global electric platform that Hyundai Motor Group has developed that's going to be used by Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis vehicles over the next several years. I think they said they're going to have 23 different models off of this platform by 2025. And we've already seen the Hyundai Ioniq 5, which should be arriving here sometime this summer. EV6 is coming beginning of next year. What do you think of this car?
First of all, I am still angry. I'm not angry, but disappointed that no one said, hey, maybe we should not call it the EGMP because it says EGIMP for their electronic platform.
Until you said it. I'm like, what is he talking about? And I looked at it.
Sorry. Now I've ruined it for you and for everyone listening.
Dang it, Roberto.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Okay, that's okay. I'll get over it. I'm shaking it off.
I apologize. I'm happy that the Hyundai Group is going with an 800-volt system. Ford, the F-150, 400 volts. Mercedes, 400 volts. I'm like, what are these people doing? You need the 800-volt system if you want to have that quick charging, if you want to just point at Tesla and say, hey, we can charge as quickly as whatever you're building. You know, right. Now we're just waiting for the infrastructure in order
quicker,
to do it.
Quicker, actually.
Yeah, quicker. It's like, you know, what is it, 350?
350 kilowatts. So, yeah. You know, they can go to any of the 600-plus Electrify America stations now and find a 350-kilowatt charger and top this thing up.
It can go from 10 to 80%, which is 210 miles in 18 minutes.
Yep.
Bam.
That's fast.
That is fast.
That's faster than a Porsche Taycan.
Yeah.
So the Taycan only does 270.
It is. You know, I like the way it looks, but the Hyundai looks better. The Ioniq 5.
Yeah, I mean this is an interesting new design direction, I think, for Kia. I think the one of the neat elements is at the tail. You know, it's got kind of this little mini ducktail type of thing. You know, that incorporates the light strip all the way around it. They're calling this thing a crossover, it's more like, you know, I'm not sure what the hell to call this thing.
Is it CUV, right? Crossover. Yeah.
It's a slightly taller five-door hatch.
Yeah. It looks sort of hatchbacky, but I get it. I get the crossover. It's a squished crossover.
Yeah. Because it's got a very short
that
hood.
Doesn't have any kind of marketing ring to it, though.
No.
The new Kia squished crossover. But it's very low. The roof is very low. So I don't know.
But is it low or is it a little? Is it low or is it a trick? Because the Ioniq 5 is like the same height as like a CRV.
Right. Like this is really like I'm looking at pictures.
I think it's a visual trick.
So does it just make it look very low to try to make it look somehow like, you know, everybody wants the sleek and sporty thing going on?
Yeah.
Is that what they're trying to do?
Really short hood, you know, because
the base of the windshield
comes right up, you know, to like the middle of the right up to the front axle. And so you've got a long greenhouse that I think makes it visually look lower than it is.
I like the profile, though. Like, there's this one really cool profile shot that they have, and it looks pretty. It looks slick. I like it.
And it
looks cool.
They're going to have a GT model with 576 horsepower, 0 to 60 in less than 3.5 seconds, which will be the quickest Kia ever.
The quickest Kia ever.
Ever.
I think this is going to be cool. I like the interior design stuff that they showed off too, because Kia always does sort of fun stuff with lighting. It's like it's its own little segment, fun with lighting from Kia. Like they always do these neat little interior treatments. And when you look at the interior shots of this, they've done some neat stuff. It's got some nice interior lighting and it seems like it has a nice design. I like how they have even the cell phone charger positioned on the center console. Is the start button on that too?
Looks like it, yeah.
The start button's on the center console. That's kind of slick. It just has a different look. I like it when they do something different and attractive and eye-catching, and it definitely has that.
It also has an augmented reality heads-up display. So, you know, the heads-up display will display information in multiple planes. You know, so like on heads-up displays today, you know, you see the information floating above your hood somewhere, and everything's in the same plane. You know, so it's the same focus point, but this is going to be multiple planes. So when you're using navigation and, you know, it's telling you where to turn, it'll look like the arrows are actually on the road at the point where you're supposed to turn. And as you get closer to it, you know, it'll grow
They show an image of exactly what you're talking about, and they show the one that just has arrows pointing to the left, which kind of looks like the traditional head-up display we're all used to. But the arrows to the right that are angled and look like they're right, that is actually kind of neat. That would be really neat to teach, because there's the worst when you're trying to follow the right turn and you're looking at a right, you're like, where is my right in real time? Oh wait, there it is behind me now. Like, you know, right. So to see this and have it kind of angling like right about here, that would be really neat. I like this. Do that on all the head-up displays.
There will be several next year. The Cadillac Lyriq is also going to have the same type of system.
Similar kind of thing. That's a cool system. I would like to see that live and in person and see if it keeps me from missing as many turns as I currently miss. So.
Me too. And of course, since this is electric and it's so quiet, you'll actually really be able to take advantage of the Kia Sounds of Nature feature in this thing as well.
It's raining. And you're like, what? Okay, sure. I'll just turn that on.
You're sitting in a Paris cafe.
The cafe one. I kept coming up to cafe and something I was driving. And my daughter's like, why does it sound like a coffee shop in the car? I'm like, oh, let me turn that off.
And also, this, I wonder if it still has the recorder, like the voice recorder. Like you can just record your voice. Like there's a voice recorder in Kia Hyundai's. And so sometimes I will just like record my voice. And I'm like, hey, it's Roberto Baldwin. Hi, fellow automotive journalist. And then I'll just leave it there and go on my way. I have no idea.
I so want to get a car that you drove and did that in. Dang it, but you're too far away.
Okay, let's get on to some listener questions or comments. First one was an email that came in from Jonathan Bonesteel. And he sent us a photograph. There's no actual question. Just sent us a photograph and just had the comment, shouldn't this be in Australia? And if you scroll down and look at that, you will see a photo of what appears to be a Holden Ute, which is the Australian word for pickup truck. Back before GM and Ford stopped building vehicles in Australia, they used to build these car-based pickup trucks, you know, that were essentially modern-day iterations on the classic El Camino idea. And interestingly, this car was photographed about 5 minutes from my house, right in front of the Epsi Food Co-op, where I go every Saturday morning to pick up
some
stuff.
Maybe this guy was stalking you. Is he waiting to see you on your Saturday morning grocery run? And he's like, wait, cool car. Forget about Sam.
It could be. Yeah, it could very well be. Thinking about this, there's a regulation that now they changed some years back that once a car that was built for an overseas market is more than 25 years old, you can now import them into the United States without having to go through the process of federalizing it, without meeting U.S. emission standards and, you know, putting U.S. headlights and bumpers and all the other stuff. So if it's over 25 years old, you can import it. This car is very clearly not 25 years old. You know, this is a car that was built somewhere in the latter half of the 2000s, maybe early 2010s, based on the model that this is. And so you wouldn't have been able to import this, you know, without going through the normal federalization process and getting it certified.
Are there that many things that you would have to change on this?
There's quite a few. Yeah.
Yeah. And it would be significant. Like
there's a fairly significant number. But there is one possible explanation for why this car exists in Ypsilanti. If you'll recall, back in 2008, In 2008, just before everything went sideways and GM went through bankruptcy and they killed off Pontiac and Saturn and Saab and Hummer, they, at the 2008 New York Auto Show, the Pontiac press conference had a very interesting pairing on the stage. Bob Lutz and 50 Cent there to announce the Pontiac G8 SUT, I think they called it, which was basically one of these utes because, you know, Pontiac had been selling the G8, which was a U.S. version of the Holden Commodore for several years. And people had been clamoring, please bring us the pickup. We want a modern El Camino.
Yeah.
And so they announced it. They showed it on stage at the New York Auto Show. I was there at that press conference. And that's the last time we ever saw it because less than a year later, the Pontiac brand was dead.
Gone.
The G8 was dead. The pickup was dead.
Everything was dead.
But in that time period, in that interim, you know, GM had certainly brought over some of those vehicles and they were doing the development work and going through the certification process because it was supposed to go on sale in 2009. So they would have had some here that were U.S. legal. And my guess is that this is one of those development vehicles that somehow slipped through the cracks and got out of the Milford Proving Grounds.
Yeah, because it shouldn't have. If it's a development, it should have like died
it should,
there.
It should have gone to the crusher.
Never have made it. Its life should have ended in a squish. But
unless it was like a late pre-production model, you know, because when they're going through the launch process, you know, once they've finished development and they're going through, getting everything, you know, the final certification, the last, you know, few hundred pre-production cars that they build are technically what they call saleable. So they are compliant with all the rules. But you know, those are usually kept, you know, within the company and they're driven by employees, you know, for a few months as part of what they call a captured test fleet to shake them out, find any last minute bugs and things like that. My guess is this is one of those late pre-production models that was considered saleable and some GM engineer decided I want it, bought it, and then replaced the Pontiac badges with Holden badges.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, because if they had kept it as like a museum piece, then it would still have the Pontiac badges.
Right.
There you go.
They would have messed with it.
Because that was my thought. I'm like, but if it has the Holden badges.
Right. The Holden badges mess up that theory. Yeah.
Interesting.
So random, I don't know. You see, now you have to pay more attention when you're at the market, Sam. See if you can see this guy. Throw yourself in front of the vehicle and say, stop. We need to know how you got this here.
I will definitely be keeping an eye out for this vehicle now.
I feel like if we call GM, they're gonna like chase, like hunt this guy down and take his car
I know,
away.
It'll be the guy's gonna be like, dang it, you guys, you busted.
Come on. Don't be a narc.
Okay. We also got some questions from some listeners on Twitter. First one is from somebody named Rebecca Drives. I No idea who she is.
Who the heck is that?
I don't know, but she had three questions, really.
Three.
I know she's overdoing
That's not really allowed for future reference, Rebecca. Okay. It's one question per listener.
Yeah. Or at least one question per tweet.
Per tweet.
Okay. All three of them were in the same question?
They were all in the same tweet. Yeah. So the three questions are, what is the meaning of life?
42.
What are you wearing? And are you my mother? So let's start with you, Nicole.
What is the meaning of life? Isn't it 42? The answer to the meaning of the question. Isn't that, am I getting the right thing? Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or one of those things?
I do believe that is the correct answer. Yes.
I believe 42 is the correct answer. Thank you very much. What am I wearing? A jean jacket. Are you my mother? No, I'm not. Can't help you with that one.
Robbie, you have any responses?
Okay. So the meaning of life is have fun, but not at the expense of others. I am wearing, I don't know, a hoodie and a shirt. I had to wear a button-up shirt because I had a drive program earlier today. And what was the last question? Oh, no, I am no.
Are you Rebecca's mother?
I don't believe so. I'm pretty sure I'm not. I would say I'm 97% sure that I am not Rebecca's mother.
Okay. I can say with, I'm going to go with 99% certainty that I am not Rebecca's mother.
Only 99? There's that 1% possibility. Okay. I appreciate
you. You can never be absolute about these things.
Yeah. You know, okay, that's fair. That's fair, Sam. That's fair.
You know, you always got to leave a little wiggle room. And, you know, okay. I mean, I have worked in PR in the past, so I know the importance of using weasel words. What am I wearing? I'm wearing a Mustang t-shirt and shorts. And the meaning of life is whatever the hell you think it is. Whatever you want it to be.
Whatever.
Enjoy it. All right. It is coming up on 9:28 Eastern time. And I believe you have to leave, right, Nicole?
I do. I have to disappear. I'm picking up a child who is arriving back from college, and she will be at the airport standing there sadly with her bag if I don't show up. So I'm going to have to cut out a little bit early, guys, but it is fun. And, you know, be nice while I disappear and you finish the podcast, and I'll see you guys next week.
All right. See you next time.
Bye, Nicole. Bye.
All right. And then next question came from Coach Cabrera. What is the long-term plan for disposing of all these electric car batteries? It's a good question because there's going to be a hell of a lot of them. I think the big thing is recycling, trying to recycle, because we're going to be making so many batteries. In fact, one thing we didn't talk about was Ford this morning announced a joint venture with SK Innovation. They're going to get into battery cell production as well, along with GM and Volkswagen and Stellantis and probably other automakers. And, you know, they talked about Ford alone, for North America, expects that by 2030, they're going to need 140 gigawatt hours a year worth of lithium ion batteries. And so that's going to take a lot of raw materials, you know, that raw materials that are not currently mined and processed, like lithium mm-hmm. and manganese and nickel and cobalt, at least not in sufficient quantities. And so the key is going to be recycling these batteries and getting those raw materials back out of depleted batteries and putting them back into new batteries.
Yeah, a lot. And so there's recycling. You want to extract all the important bits back out of the batteries. And a lot of automakers also talked about how you could repurpose the batteries, because if you take a battery out of a car, which is a pretty extreme environment, and you do something like a power wall, like Tesla's power wall, where you have an environment where the battery isn't being charged and discharged as quickly and as heavily as it would in a car, and it would work great in, you know, homes or in, you know, manufacturer settings, or, you know, in those, like, you know, the giant sort of power grid, instead of using peakers, you know, more and more utilities are using batteries connected to some, you know, either solar or wind. And so that's another way that you can, you know, continue to use the battery as long as it has something usable in it. And then once it gets to it's completely depleted, then you start, you know, ripping them apart and getting all those sweet delicious minerals.
Yeah. Did you see the video that Volkswagen put out about a month and a half, 2 months ago? They have a pilot recycling plant in Germany, and they had a video showing the shredder that they have for battery modules.
Oh wow! No, I missed that.
Oh, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But basically, you know, if you think of what a paper shredder looks like, mm-hmm. imagine one scaled up that can take an aluminum box, you know, that's maybe 2 feet by, you know, 8 inches high and a foot wide. And you just drop that box in there and it shreds it into little shreds, into little chunks that they can then take and process to extract all those materials back out of it. It's really amazing to watch.
Wow. Yeah. And then, you know, it's funny because you think, well, maybe they open it up and they very gently pull things out. You're like, nope, shred it and suck everything out.
Yep. No, you know, they all they do is they make sure that the battery is completely discharged first before they stick it in there, and then just drop it in there and shred it and run it through a bunch of processes to get the, and VW claims that they can get back about 95% of the key raw materials out of this. So the aluminum, the lithium, manganese, cobalt, and nickel.
Wow. So that's impressive. And that's now, yeah. And that's, you know, that's as we're sort of on the cusp of start, like, you know, EVs becoming mainstream vehicles. You know, in 5 years, I would hope they could, you know, bring that up to 98%, 99%.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. One last one from Oleg Kolupev. Sorry if I've mangled your last name there, Oleg. In light of the changes at Waymo recently, they've had some management changes. John Krafcek stepped down as CEO. Actually, a report just came out saying that they're looking to raise another $4 billion in external funding. How many players in autonomous cars will we have in 5 years? Do you see any being acquired by the car manufacturers? So right now, I would wager that by 2025, 26 timeframe, we will probably be down to maybe 10 major players. It might well be less than that. I think most of the smaller companies will have gotten either acquired by somebody or gone out of business by that time. And probably by the end of the decade, we'll probably be down to 5 or 6. But I don't actually see most of these companies being acquired by automakers. There are a number of them, like Cruise, that is majority owned by GM and Honda right now. Argo AI is mostly owned by Volkswagen and Ford. But I think, you know, I think what's more likely to happen is rather than being acquired by car makers, they're going to stay independent. And in fact, the ones that are currently controlled by automakers are all looking at potential IPOs in the next mm-hmm. couple of years, including potentially Waymo. Which might IPO, you know, out of Alphabet. Have you heard anything different?
No, you know, and I think what's happened in the last year and a half, 2 years, is everyone has come to the realization that autonomous vehicles are incredibly difficult. It is not as easy as everyone thought. They knew it would be hard, but they didn't realize how hard, and they didn't realize how the resources needed. That just the cash, and then Waymo needs $4 billion. $4 billion. That is a lot of money. And Waymo's been testing forever, and they still, you know, we still don't have an autonomous car as far as, you know, and I'm still thinking we're, you know, another decade before, you know, someone can buy a consumer autonomous car. It is far more difficult than people realize. And I think there was a rush, like there's a rush right now on EV stocks. I think there was sort of a rush on, you know, investing in autonomous vehicles. And now that rush has sort of come to an end as everyone's sort of like, oh, this is really, really hard. And so, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of consolidation. And, you know, like you said, there's going to be companies that are invested in by automakers, but aren't, you know, outright controlled by them, because the automakers at this point are sort of like, well, this is a lot of money. Why don't we just like help these other people? And then when they have it, then we can use it.
Yeah. And, you know, in the meantime, you know, what they're doing is they're taking some of the lessons that have been learned, both, you know, in terms of software, but also, you know, some of the sensor developments, and incorporating that into more advanced driver assist systems. So, you know, we're starting to see cars coming to market this year and next with LiDAR sensors, with, you know, you're going to start seeing vehicles with imaging radar sensors, near infrared cameras, you know, all kinds of features that were developed for automated driving. But, you know, some of that technology is ready now. And so they can start getting some return on their investment by incorporating that and improving the capability of their ADAS systems, and making conventional vehicles, human driven vehicles, safer.
Yeah, I mean, the use of LiDAR as an additional sensor in the vehicle to make it safer is great, because, you know, there's limitations to a camera, there's limitations to radar, there's limitations to ultrasonic, and so when you have essentially, if you have a lot of sensors, you have a lot of redundancy. So if something isn't working because of inclement weather, or, you know, something got on the sensor, you know, that's just one more piece of equipment that's going to, you know, maybe an emergency brake, maybe emergency, turn left or right. You know, every little sensor, everything you put on that creates additional redundancy, especially in emergency situations, is a good thing. And, you know, the price is coming down on things like LiDAR and stuff, where, you know, before it was like, it's $160,000 or some ridiculous amount. And, you know, that those prices have dropped a lot.
Yeah, I mean, some of the low end flash LiDARs are, you know, in the range of, you know, up to a couple hundred dollars now or less.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's the point where it starts to become viable to install those on vehicles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the high performance LiDARs are still several thousand dollars, but and those are, you know, still primarily just for, you know, the fully automated vehicles. But we're going to see a lot more of that technology filtering down into the vehicles that we drive every day over the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's smarter safety features is essentially what's coming for the next, you know, 5-10 years.
Yep. All right. Well, that's it for this week. You got anything interesting going on this week?
What do I have going on this week? Oh, I'm getting the Polestar tomorrow. The Polestar 2. I've driven it, you know, briefly, you know, like, you know, for an hour or two. So I'll have that for a few days, and I'll have a review of that coming to Engadget. I'm getting the ID4 for like the 30th time. I'm doing a review of that. I also get the Honda Ridgeline and the I can't remember the little like crazy thing. Raptor? No. Anyway, they have like a little four-wheel drive, off-road thing. What's it called?
Yeah, I know the one. The Honda.
Talon.
Right?
The Talon.
The Talon. Yes.
The Honda Talon. The side by side. You can take your friend and scare the hell out of them on a dirt road or sand or whatever.
Cool.
So I have a lot of stuff going on.
Well, it's, you know, when you're a freelancer, it's better than the opposite. So,
yeah, you're just always like, okay, I got to do this, I got to
rent.
As long
as you can find somebody to pay for all the stories.
Yeah. We just got to be like, hey, you want to give me some money?
All right, thanks everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.